So I've been teaching at Zen Center for a long time, and I've given a lot of Dharma talks over the years. And there's one teaching that I'm always teaching. And since I give so many different talks, I always try to figure out how to teach it in different ways so people won't get totally bored. Well, that's, I don't know how well I do at that, but that is my goal. So I try to prepare my talks because, you know, I want to help you guys stay on the path. And my central teaching is that there's a quiet joy in here. It's right in here. You're looking at me, but it's right in your body, in your Dharma container. It's a quiet joy. And there's all this teaching about the quiet joy, all these scriptures, you know, all these scholars, all these books Ben and I have written. But it's all about this. It's all pointing to this. So don't get confused by all that stuff. It's pointing to this. This quiet joy isn't of time or space. Really. It's not something I read about. You feel it. This last year has been a hard year, the hardest year for folks in our community, our American community, that I can remember. Back to when I was, you know, how I can remember pretty young, 3 years old. World War had just ended when I was 3 years old. This has been a hard year, but that quiet joy is still here. And we aspire in our practice to open up to it, to ascend to the illumined state, the enlightened state. Traveling up the Eightfold Path or some other religion, some other path. We're traveling along the path. Step one of the path, we understand we're all interconnected. Step two of the path, we have an intention to learn that and manifest that so we can feel it in our heart and mind. And then speech, action, and livelihoods, our behavior, ethical, and then our meditation. The last three steps. And I've just been doing a program with this morning I'll meet with kids after I meet with you guys, a bunch of kids, a small bunch of kids. And I've been doing the Eightfold Path with them. And we've only gotten to right action. And we're gonna end pretty soon. So we'll probably only get to right action, but that's fine. We do practice meditation too. So we do actually do all the steps on the path. But the Eightfold Path is, when I teach it as a spiral. It's a spiral. We ascend it, but it never ends. It's a spiral. We get to eight. Eight is right concentration. And then we move into one again. Understanding, although our understanding is a little less in our heads and a little more right here in our bodies, then we go up again and go over again our whole lives, just like people in 12 steps, you know, they do, they work the steps and they go back and work the steps together. Now we work the Eightfold Path steps over and over, over and over. And of course, we have to have some trust to do that. But through that, we convert our understanding into wisdom. But if you think you've got wisdom, that's not what I'm talking about. It's just right here, just being here with this. So when we do the spiral, if we keep doing it and do our good sitting practice, we can get disoriented. We can get dizzy. And we can even, in a retreat, lose our sense of time and space, forget what step we're on. And people come in to have one-to-ones with me during a retreat, and they tell me about this, that they're getting dizzy or disoriented, and I say, and they're losing track of time and space. And I say, good, good. you don't have to come in and see me because that's what I'm going to say to you. But I'm happy to have you come in and see me. So then at some point we're so engrossed in our meditation that we're no longer trying to climb up or down. We're just here. And then we have the opportunity to fall into no thingness, to fall right into no thingness, what Hangzhe calls the silent illumination of the empty field. He's a great poet, 12th century Chinese poet, the silent illumination of the empty field. And Hangzhe says, when silence and illumination both are operating complete, the flower of the lotus opens and the dreamer awakens. So first we climb, climb, climb. At some point there's a release. We release. We're released of both climbing and falling. But we have these images that we congeal around. These images of who we are, who we have been, who we should be, and they stop us. They have a crippling effect. We're caught by the image of something or other. And I have talked before about the Greek gardener, god Narcissus. He was just a young youth, an adolescent youth. And then he saw his reflection in the stream. Oh, he was fixated on it. I looked in the mirror before I came on screen today. Just make sure my hair, you know, I have a lot of hair. It's one of my only good features as I age. Well, that's fine. If you can do it playfully, do it. But don't get stuck on it. Poor Narcissus turned into a plant. He was no longer human anymore. He was just a plant. Is it possible for us to open beyond our masks, beyond the images? Here's Basho's poem. Year after year, a monkey's face wears a monkey's mask. Year after year, a monkey's face wears a monkey's mask. So I worked with a guy named Bob. Bob was a high-powered attorney, and he was really an arguer, really a good arguer and debater everywhere. That was his mask. That's how he had learned to survive and prevail in a difficult childhood. But who didn't have a difficult childhood? Who didn't? Who didn't have a difficult adolescence? But that was the mask, his predominant mask. And I don't know why his wife never left him, but at least she hadn't left him the last time I talked with him. I know why she didn't leave him, because he listened to her and they were going to have a family reunion with her family. And she said, Bob, I want you to do your best to put a friendly face on. So he did his best. He bit his tongue. He was frustrated. He still had the urge to argue or debate, but he did it. But then when he got home, he was exhausted. Our masks, when we don't have them, we get tired. Oh, I just have to be raw. I don't know if I want to be raw. Our monkey faces, our monkey masks, the personas that we use to project a sense of adequacy or competence. Of course we want to be competent. We want to see people as competent. But if we get stuck on the mask, we're not alive anymore. Bob's mask became solid through his conditioned learning. Your masks have become solid through your conditioned learning. For the family reunion, he was able to put on another mask, a friendly mask, a smile that covered his clenched teeth when he wanted to argue. I've only known men like this. I haven't known any women like this. It's a predominant male mask. I'm sure women do it too. I'm sure trans people do it too, but I've only known men who did it. So disguising his original face before he was born. Disguising your original face before you were born. This is woman's comment. What is your original face before you were born, says woman? What is the face behind the face? The haste, the face behind all those faces. If we ascend the path for a while with our two good legs of meditation and ethical behavior, as we continue to walk, we can begin to feel something deeper in our body, in our Dharma container, deeper than our different personas. Woman, who died 50 years before Dogen was born in China, was also known for his statement, take one step off the 100-foot pole, which I just talked about. Then we experience a wonderful luminosity radiating from our original faces. We experience a wonderful luminosity radiating from our original faces. So my first teacher was Suzuki Roshi. I talked about a whole bunch about him, but there was another teacher only three blocks away in San Francisco, another Buddhist teacher, Buddhist meditation teacher, a Chan teacher named Tolan. I went to see Tolan every week for a while. I did both at the same time. He had a brilliant, he had a really warm smile, and he wore this saffron robe that was really brilliant, really brilliant. And Suzuki had gotten kind of boring to me. A teacher can get kind of boring to you. If I've been your teacher, you think, ho-hum, and you just want to take a nap. It happens. He got kind of boring for me. So Tolan, wow, warm smile, not boring, exciting, trippy, showed us his scars from moxa burning. Oh, moxa burning, ancient Chinese Buddhist way of being. Told us about the cave he lived in when he was in China. Doing his meditation just like Bodhidharma, wolves coming around. Then in dream time, a wolf coming into his consciousness. The wolf became his archetype. Said the wolf told him to come to the United States. He didn't know what America was, but somehow he got a boat to San Francisco, where there's a huge Chinatown in San Francisco, but he only spoke Mandarin. He didn't speak Cantonese. So when he went to Chinatown, he'd have to have a translator, the poor guy. So he was just in this little apartment on Sutter Street, five blocks from where our Zen Center was. But I went to see him every week for a while, because he seemed like Suzuki, just natural, just carried himself naturally. His talks were somewhat indecipherable without a translator, but I didn't care. He didn't seem like he was wearing a mask. Now, maybe that's just my projection. our projections are fine. We need projections sometimes, but I think it's more than my projection. I think it's true. I know it's true. We can see through these masks, through our practice. We can. So last time I saw him, many, many years ago, there were still only four or five people who came every week to be with him, and including these women who cooked for him, because he was vegetarian. I don't know why. I guess they were just his students. Yeah, you cook for your teacher. That's cool. You cook for teacher. Many years later, after I came to Minnesota, I started hearing about the city of 10,000 Buddhas in Northern California. And who was the teacher there? Tolan. Huge monastery. Many, many monks. Many, many monks. So I don't know what happened. He got discovered. Suzuki got discovered too. They both got discovered. It was an interesting phase of kind of Buddhism. When it first came to the United States, these teachers were just hanging out, and then they got discovered. Ooh. So, if we do this practice, if we let our masks fall away on their own, the Rinzai's person, true person of no rank, comes forth. When I went to Tolan, a book over by Lin Chi, the real name of Rinzai, and I had that underlined, let the person of naked red flesh come forth. And then I saw Tolan. I thought, oh, cool, cool. And I had been at Stanford for a few years. I ended up at Stanford for quite a few years as an undergraduate because I did not do too well. Fussed off a lot, did not do too well. Then none of those Stanford professors were just naked as they were. They were all, in my opinion, they all wore masks. They all wore masks. And I wanted to put those aside. And just as I know you, most of you guys do. And when I asked Tolan about this, he said, meditate on woman's statement. What was your original face before your parents were born? He was a koan teacher. So coincidentally or synchronistically, he said, do that. Okay. But I was hopelessly confused as I did it. Week after week, I didn't do it at Suzuki's place because I didn't like doing it. And then I got tired of hearing Tolan's stories. And I got tired of him showing me his scars. He even took his robe up once when the women weren't there and showed me the moxa burns on his chest. What a trip. What a trip. So then I returned to Suzuki. But I was long for that childlike naturalness that is right here in heart mind. It's right here. The more I compared my own tumult to other students, the less I had hope that my meditation practice would bear fruit. Oh, maybe another teacher. Maybe I can find another teacher. I looked all around Northern California. I found one other teacher. This is a long time ago. Now, in San Francisco alone, I think there are, Dharma transmitted teachers. There must be 200, 300, 400, I don't know. I found a guy, a white guy. I found a white guy. Not that I was looking for a white guy. I just found a white guy. I went to visit him at his monastery. And he was trying to teach me something. He thought I needed to shape up and be someone I wasn't. I could feel that mask. I didn't want that. I'd had enough of that. I ran back to San Francisco. I ran back to San Francisco. So our identity is based on this complex, interwoven series of attitudes and habit patterns that we develop as a kid, as an adolescent, many of which we're not conscious of, but our basic life orientation gets based on those. But it's possible to move beyond that. That's the teaching. Shakespeare reminds us of that when he says, this above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. So Tolan didn't hide behind his robes. Instead, he pulled his robes up to show me his scars. What a trip. Oh, what about this? What about this self underneath that's naked? I thought there was no self in Buddhism. But what does the Diamond Sutra say? It says, awaken to the mind which does not abide anywhere, which does not fix anywhere, which does not get stuck anywhere. I'm elaborating on the Diamond Sutra. we have a radiant and resilient self underneath. This empty field self underneath our monkey masks is always here. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? And all we need to do is negotiate the spiral of the path. And then when we're ready, whether we know it or not, we'll take a step off. If you try to take a step off, you'll get really scared. So you don't try. At some point, as Dogen would say, body and mind just drop away. And you know, that happens usually in a monastic setting or in a retreat setting. That's why all of the priests in training here for years, I've said, you got to do 18 days of retreat a year. It's not, that's the only reason, because daily life, we get masked up for daily life. And retreats is our opportunity. Or monasteries. I was lucky as a young man to live in a monastery for a while. This is about authenticity, but we can't get it. As soon as we try to get it, it's gone. As soon as we think we've got it, it's gone. Oh, I've got it. No. You don't have it. You've got the mask of I've got it. Right. Oh, I got it mask now. Now I'm going to open my own monastery and you guys are going to all come to visit me because I got it. Right. Human beings are kind of weird. Cool weird, I think. Cool weird, but weird. So this is a meditation practice, becoming aware of our masks, beginning to notice how congealed habit patterns stifle us, turning into these masks. They're not really solid, but as long as we're captured by any image of ourselves, our original face is covered up. But it original face is connected to everything, including our masks. So don't worry. Our masks are a manifestation of our original face too. All we need to do is bring the person of naked red flesh forth. And she'll come forth on her own if you do this practice. You don't have to bring her forth. She'll just come forth. We experience real lightness when we shut our masks. They're pretty heavy. Right? They're pretty heavy. But as we long to discard these masks so we can live more lightly, we can continue to cling to the mask of wanting to live more lightly. We just keep going up this spiral. I don't know either way why. And I can't tell you how long it will take you. And I can't even say there's a final result. I'm asking like there's a final result. There's no final result because it just goes on forever. Sometimes we wear masks still. Sometimes I get stuck on masks still. I haven't culminated in perfect final enlightenment. What's that? That's a mask. Permanent final enlightenment. Ask of me being the one, right? I'm the one. Ted's my successor, but I'm the one. Bring the person of naked red flesh forth on her own. Each time we get lost in a moment of anger or frustration, we're creating the conditions for further anger or frustration, which means more mask making. We condition our mind to return again and again to thoughts which perpetuate our fear and anger, and we become a fearful person, an angry person, a depressed person. There have been a lot of people who've been telling me this last year that they've turned into a depressed person. It's not surprising, is it? I've turned into a depressed, anxiety-filled person. But you're not. That's a mask. Yes, you experience anxiety. Who wouldn't this last year? Yes, you experienced some times when you felt hopeless. Who wouldn't you this past year? But you're not that kind of a person. That's your mask. So many of you have heard me talk before about my childhood mask of giftedness. It sounds like a great mask, right? I got it when I was 4 years old, and my mother took me to Berkeley something or other center to get my IQ tested. Ugh, sounds like a wonderful mask. So wonderful, but so stultifying that I was in the seventh or eighth grade and I got a bad report card. Do you remember what I did? I rode my bicycle to the President Hotel in Palo Alto and ran up to the fourth floor because I was going to kill myself. I was going to kill myself. That's how much good my gifted mask did for me as a child. Right? That's how much good. But then I looked down, I saw the face, and I thought, oh no. And I ran back down the stairs and I biked home really fast without showing my parents my report card, telling them I'd lost it. The dog had eaten it, I told them. Pocahontas, my dog, had eaten it. Didn't get away with that. And I continued on the path. When I got on into Zen Center, my giftedness didn't help me any. But I continued on the path anyway. And I got kind of desperate and hopeless after practicing for a few years. But I just, with my encouragement of my teacher, who I felt was with me always, even though he wasn't. Well, it was not many of us then. So actually, he was almost there with me always. And I just stayed and kept spiraling along, although it felt like I was in a reverse spiral. If you feel like you're in a reverse spiral, that's a good sign. That's a good sign. Stay in your reverse spiral, but stay on the path. Stay on the path, because you have a chance to move beyond the time-space neurological lock. You have a chance. You have a chance. Then something happened during a retreat, and the tension that held my gifted mask, alternating with my hopeless mask, my despairing mask, my giftedness almost was of no use at Zen Center, but my despairing mask was a lot of use in retreats. My hopeless mask was a huge use in retreats. I'm chuckling, but some of you, any of you who've done a lot of retreats know what I'm talking about. At some point, they fell away. Took the step off the 100-foot pole. And the person of naked flesh comes forth for you too. So a student came to me a few years ago and said, after the fifth day of our longest retreat, and said, I feel like people can look right through me. I feel raw and naked and a little disoriented. What do I do? And I said, oh, that's wonderful. Do nothing. That's wonderful. Do nothing. Just go back and sit. And I knew that she was ready to fall off the 100-foot pole. I knew that. Heart mind, right here. We need to let go of each thought as it arises. It's a tedious process. I'm sorry that Zazen is such a tedious process for you. It takes patience and persistence and patience. But the Diamond Sutra tells us, tap into the mind which does not abide anywhere. Isn't that cool? It's right here. It doesn't abide anywhere. Just tap into it. And then your masks begin to disintegrate, they fall away, and you've got your original face before your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents and your great-great-grandparents were born. The quiet joy of just living, just being here with each other, just suffering, just not suffering. Maybe this suffering year is almost over. I don't know. I hope so. But I don't want to get too hopeful because I'll get all masked up with my hope. And then I won't be able to be here with this quiet joy that's just always here. Just hanging out. So that's what I want to say for this morning. Thank you.